Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. We're happy to have you joining us here for this exciting show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. Today, we're going to be talking about options trading with Jeff Bishop. Really excited to dig into some of these Wall Street secrets with him. I know his track record's pretty awesome, and I know you guys are going to get a lot just like I did. But before we talk to our guest, I want to talk about Betterment. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, go to moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So today we're talking with Jeff Bishop. How's it going today, Jeff?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing awesome. For those of you who don't know Jeff, he's a multimillionaire trader and economist with nearly 20 years of experience under his belt. He's failed building four businesses, which I'd love to hear about.
At least four,
yes. And I don't think you can become a success unless you've failed at least four businesses. He's tried his hand at online poker, which I give him credit for because I think that would be challenging not seeing who you're playing against. And he's became a multimillionaire before the age of 35. So he has a pretty special gift and passion for trading options, which is really why we have him on the show. So Jeff, let's talk about some of your failures first. So you failed at four businesses. What have you done prior to this? What brought you to this point where you've become successful as an option trader?
Yeah, so you don't start off that way for sure. No one starts off day one being successful trading options. It's a long road to get there. You know, I first got started, I was in my undergraduate degree, went to University of Texas, was in the finance program. You know, I started learning just about the stock market in general, and I really became attracted to what you could do with options. I learned just basic strategies and how they work. So that became pretty interesting to me. I went to do my graduate degree in economics, and I made an emphasis on finance in that degree. And several of my classes, I really studied more just the minutiae and details of how options worked, way more than anyone should even care about. I've always been fascinated by it, how there's so many different strategies you can put into place and the leverage you can use. That always attracted me. I had no money and I wasn't trading really, so it wasn't a big deal at the time. But yeah, first getting started training, just kind of as the internet was getting started. So 20 years ago, hard to believe the internet's only been around about 20 years. That's crazy.
I know. Things have really sped up quite quickly in the last...
It just doesn't seem like that long, but you look at it, it's like such an integral part of everything we do now. Like my kids have never even grown up knowing there wasn't internet. So
it's a scary thought. I mean, to think about the iPhone, like somebody brought, I forget the date, but the iPhone has only been around for what? 15 years, 12 years?
Maybe, yeah. I remember my old BlackBerry. It took me forever to go to an iPhone. I can't believe it.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one. There was a chart I saw with BlackBerries, and it went down to basically close to zero users. It went from like, all the users down to zero. I was like, oh, there I am at the end,
Exactly. I was a holdout until a few years ago, maybe 5 years now. I thought I could never get over not typing the buttons.
Yeah, the buttons are important, but now that I get rid of it, it's okay, I guess. I just use the voice recorder and transcription service to make up for it.
Yeah, I can't believe I held out so long, but it was a great phone, man. It changed my life.
So why options? Why not? I mean, you could trade anything.
I do like to trade stocks quite a bit. I trade smaller cap stocks more than anything, really, because I feel like you've got more of an edge with small cap stocks. I feel like those markets aren't as efficient. People aren't as rational. You're not playing with the biggest players in the market all the time. So I feel like small cap stocks give you more of an edge. So if I do trade, that's probably stocks I want to go after. And then in investing, I'm holding long-term stocks. You know, as far as trading, I'm a pretty short-term trader, not really day trading, but I'm looking at trades. I'm a swing trader, so looking at trades the next few days or a couple of weeks if it takes that long to pan out.
So can you kind of define some of these terms for our listeners? Because I think some people who do this will understand, like you and I understand the terms, but a lot of listeners probably won't. How do you define the difference between a day trader and a swing trader?
You know, I think you're going to get different answers depending on who you ask, but you know, day traders are truly in and out of the same trade in the same day or minutes. I mean, most day traders I know are literally in a stock for seconds or minutes at a time. So they're really rapid fire, looking for short term. And I know a lot of people who are successful doing that. That never worked for me. I can never develop a good, consistent strategy that worked for day trading. But swing trading, was definitely something I was more interested in. It provided me more time. I'd have to be in front of my computer all day, which I liked. And I feel like so much noise out there in the market with algorithms and news flashes and all kinds of noise that's distracting stock movements during the day. If you get focused on a day-to-day of movement, you can get shaken out too easily. So swing trading gives me a few days or a couple of weeks to see a move play out the upside or downside, and I can ride out that volatility better. So if I give myself a little longer runway, I can ride that out. And so that ended up working for me pretty well.
Yeah, so you made a point about day trading isn't for you. You never found a way to make it work for you. This is a point I like to keep coming back to on the show because I think it's really important is your investing mindset, right? Like each one of us are wired differently. You know, we have to find a good investing mindset that works for one of us. Like Warren Buffett's obviously successful at his approach, but everybody tries to model Warren Buffett and obviously not everybody's Warren Buffett. I couldn't invest with his style the way he does. You know, somebody like you,
I've tried it, but it's just boring. Well, I'm not sure how he's got billions of dollars.
Well, I do. It's actually,
I know exactly how he does it. The thing is, you can't trade like he does or get the same deals, but I get his outlook on the market and what he does. And I really agree for that as a long-term investor. But
well, that's actually not
you have to be a really long-term investing to have that.
Yeah, that's not even his secret. I mean, Warren Buffett's secret is not that he's a great long-term investor, which he is. His secret is that he's living off a float. You know, if we wanted to borrow $1 billion to invest it in long-term investments, it would cost us 5-7%. But he gets paid to do that. He doesn't borrow money. He gets paid. People pay him to invest the money, and then he gets to basically the difference. It's like the only business in the world, the insurance business, the only business in the world where you get paid to sit on a float and invest it. It's crazy.
Well, he was pretty brilliant to realize that 40 years ago or so when he got into it. So
yeah. Well,
now he's reaping all the benefits. It's worked out.
He's a genius, and some hedge fund managers have tried to do that since and not necessarily successfully.
The way he structures deals too, man, he always has it where it's almost impossible for him to lose. That's another way that you want to make a lot of money, you do that.
Yeah. I mean, but I guess the point is like he's found something that works for him. And I think people who try to replicate other people's investing strategies, that doesn't necessarily work for them. Yeah. So like options trading, like I do options trading. So one of the reasons why I wanted you on the show is to have somebody with that experience to talk to the listeners, because it's kind of this weird asset class that most people don't understand. They think it's complicated, but how do you use options in your trading?
Yeah. So with swing trading in particular, I found that it was much easier to find predictable moves in a stock that were going to make, you know, 3-5% move in the next week or so. That's typically my time frame on a stock move. That's kind of boring as a stock trader for the most part. With options, though, that could be a 50 or 100% move in an option trade in that time period, if you're right. So that definitely got my attention more. Then my strategy primarily comes down to waiting for opportunities on these stocks where I feel like I've got an edge for that short period of time. And, you know, with stocks, they are efficient. You're trading large cap stocks, so you're not going to be right 100% of the time or even close to it. So I feel like I'm lucky to be right about 50% of the time. But if your upside is close to 100% and your downside is 50% or less, then the math starts to work out there. And that becomes a successful strategy for buying calls and puts, at least. And I also trade quite a bit on spreads and selling volatility. I feel like that is just one of the easiest ways to make money with options, though it's too boring for most people and they want to do it. But I feel like that's just the most reliable strategy to play.
Yeah, I want to come back to that because that's a little bit more complex. I want to give the listeners a little more foundation first. But how do you find your edge? Because you're talking about trades that are getting 100% in the upside, which I'm sure is appealing to a lot of people.
But you also heard 50% of the downside or more. So these are volatile.
Well, exactly.
With option trading, you have to have a wide risk tolerance for sure. And that's something I've had to learn and grow into over the years.
Yeah, but you're not putting all your money in one trade either, which is another lesson people should take into heed. But what?
Oh, absolutely. I'll talk about that too in a minute.
So how do you find your edge? Like, talk to us about how you find good trades and where your edge is.
The two best things I go after are breakouts on momentum stocks. So stocks that are I don't necessarily like, or I fundamentally don't like them. I think they're overvalued to begin with, but they keep breaking out to new high levels. Well, I just go with the charts on those. And I use the previous, after it makes a new breakout, I use that breakout as my stop of the trade. And then I let the trade go to where it wants to go. You're always surprised to see how far the market will be irrational and carry stocks higher to the upside than you ever think they will. But as a short-term trader, I feel like you can ride that, whether it's for a day or two or a week or so. Like, that is one great area I've found over the years that it's pretty successful. And the market's also way too pessimistic on selling. I feel like there's a lot of times when the market is oversold in an idea just because the sentiment so bad at the moment. I think Tesla could be an example of that at the moment. I don't want to even get in the debate on where Tesla should be. Some people are convinced it's a dollar and some people are convinced it's a thousand. I don't care. In the next week, Tesla has incredibly negative sentiment. And to me, that's a very attractive place to look as a trader. So I look for spots where Tesla could hold a base and then it retests it and tests it some more. And it begins to find some footing. And then, you know, stocks tend to run out of people who want to sell at all times. So it's just a simple supply and demand there. So I mean, opportunities like that where I think the market has really oversold something too much becomes a good place that I want to play in. Again, I get into a trade looking at a specific place I want to stop out if it doesn't work. I mean, Tesla easily could go $50 down overnight. I don't know. But I've got a stop in place. I'm going to watch the stock and I'll get out of the option if it doesn't work.
You mentioned that you work on momentum stocks, even though you hate the stocks from a value perspective. Do you consider yourself like a growth or a value kind of investor?
Both, man. So my personal portfolio that I hold like longer term, I'm very, very conservative, actually. I hold a lot of municipal bonds, dividend paying stocks, boring stuff that is just not going to do anything. It just is cash flow, perhaps, and security of principle. And then I have this active trading portfolio that is really high risk. I'm trading really high risk options. That obviously gets a much smaller percentage of my overall portfolio, but that's what I'm actively trading all the time.
Maybe you can explain the difference. You've got a conservative long-term portfolio, which sounds like it's more in line with how most people invest, but you have this short-term high-risk portfolio. What's the purpose of that portfolio? What are you trying to accomplish personally as an investor?
Yeah, so the short-term portfolio, I feel like that's where I'm able to take advantage of just the short-term mispricings on stocks and then translate on the options. So I'm looking for a short move on a stock that I feel is mispriced and could rebound or will... Either way, with options, you can profit. The stock goes up or it goes down. So I've got indicators that I look at that give me a pretty high confidence level if I feel like a stock is topped out to the upside. And then I've got an option strategy for that or to the downside, like it's oversold too much. You don't really know when it's too much, but I've got a good feel over the years when the likelihood of something reversing is going to happen.
Right. But you have your that short-term portfolio. Are you doing it to generate extra income for yourself? Or are you doing it just to kind of turn up the returns on the rest of the portfolio? Or how are you looking at that as kind of two segments of a bigger whole?
Yeah. My options trading overall now would not be something I'm relying on to feed the family. So that is definitely that's the growth part of my portfolio at this point. I feel like the bulk of it is put into really safe, conservative assets. And the option trading is something I use just for the growth booster.
Okay, cool. The one thing I like about options is that if you have a thesis on the market, you could create an option strategy around it, no matter what the thesis is.
Yeah, no matter how crazy your thesis is, you can have an option strategy for it.
Yeah. So do you have a preference in terms of buying calls and puts versus selling them?
I know that buying calls and puts has a lower statistical probability of working out in general, but again, I feel like the market, and I've proven this, the market has mispriced a lot of opportunities there. And if you're patient and not always consistently trading, if you wait for the right opportunities, I feel like traders can find those niches where the stock has a higher likelihood of going up 3% than it does down 3% from that point. And when you can identify pockets like that where the odds of something happening are higher than the odds of it not going your way, then you know in the long run, you're setting yourself up for a profitable strategy. So it's not like, is this one going to work today or tomorrow? It's will it work over the next 100 trades or so? And when you develop that as a trader, then you've really got a strategy to work with.
So walk us through how you kind of find a trade, you know, in terms of from the beginning, because there's different parts of this, right? It's not just you're looking at the options, you're looking at the underlying, and then the options is kind of an overlay as like a second layer. So it's not just about picking the stocks and the price. Like how do you go about finding investments and then how do you go about analyzing them?
Too many people rely 100% on scanning, and I don't know very many people that are successful with only scanning. There's a lot of intuition that goes into trading as well, which you kind of learn over time about how the markets are going to react, and I really utilize that a lot in my trading. Scanning, though, does have a place. It helps me find trading ideas to get on my radar. I'm constantly looking for stocks that I either love or hate, so I'm looking for stocks that are consistently outperforming the market on up days. We call those high beta stocks. So the S&P is up 1% today and the stock is up 2%. And it consistently does that. That's a high beta stock. So it's outperformed the market. But then I look and see how it does on the down days. Is it on the down days and the market's down 1%? Is it down 2% or more? If the answer is no, if it typically holds up close to flat or just slightly down, then that's a sign to me the market really likes that stock right now. So I'm looking for dips in that one when I can buy it. And then conversely, on the downside, I'm looking for stocks that I can bet against. So I'm looking for stocks that when the market does turn a little bit, stocks that I think are going to outperform to the downside. So I guess reverse the logic on it. So I'm looking to swing trade, looking for a few days. And then I'm looking at buying options that are, you know, the expiration date is probably about a month. It's about my ideal. I'm not trading weekly or 2 weeks out. I think the move and the option will happen in about a week, but I want to give myself a little more time on that. So I'm typically buying options that are about a month out. And I'm constantly building a list. So I've got this list of stocks I love and hate. And that's kind of what I'm going off every day. I'm not looking at 10,000 stocks in the market. I've probably got about 40 or 50 at any given time that I'm keeping tabs on, and I'm waiting to pounce on to the long side or the downside, depending on when it comes right.
It's great that you talk about your list that you've kind of built up. I know a lot of people kind of trade certain stocks. They have their, you know, their smaller field that they trade from, because it makes it easier, because you can't trade 5,000 stocks. You can't know them all. What do you do if, I would assume sometimes you've got your, just like in poker, like sometimes you got your mojo going and sometimes you don't.
That's exactly right.
What if you're kind of, what if you're kind of off your game with a certain stock? Do you just kind of chuck it, or do you have rules around that so you don't get caught into this, hey, I got burned, I got to make it back kind of mentality?
Yeah, you know, I've got stocks that are just on my naughty list. Aren't necessarily good or bad, but I just don't trade them well. So I've learned there's a few of them I just don't trade. I typically stay out of them. And there's stocks that I've found I've really got a good pulse on. So those are ones I'm always looking to go back to. I may not be in them often, but I'll go back a few times a year and I've got a really good feel for them. So those are the ones I really kind of keep close. But I feel like everybody should just start to build a list of stocks they get to know intimately. You can look at a chart and see how it trades, but as you watch it day by day, you really get a feel for, you know, how it reacts with the market. And I think that helps you become a better trader. So I would suggest to newer traders, just go around your house and look at some things you already like and you love. So, you know, you got an Apple computer, you got some Nike sneakers over here I like, you got a Whirlpool washing machine. You got these things in your house you already like. Just start finding the company that makes that and follow them and just see how that goes for you. See if you can start to find patterns that happen over and over again.
Yeah, that's kind of like the Peter Lynch approach, invest in what you know, right?
Yeah, just get a feel for it and then grow from there. So start like 5 stocks. And then I don't feel like you have to have hundreds of stocks you follow. You can make a good living and be successful just having, I think that universe of 50 or less is reasonable for people. And it's always fluid too. People are, I'm adding stocks, I'm taking some out. There's some I have really high conviction with, I'll stick with for a long time. And there's some that are just trades that might be here for a week or two, but they're not stocks I really care about long term.
So do you have any, you know, when you're trading, do you have any sort of rules of thumb or any list of things that people should know about either trading in general or trading options or things they should keep in mind?
Well, first of all, I think everybody who wants to be an option trader should just not trade for a while. I think you need to spend some time studying and try to work with people who are already in the market and successful. So try to learn from them. There's so much free information on options already. So spend some time getting familiar with the nuts and bolts of how options work. So that's the first thing. Like, don't go out and risk your money today. So study first. And then I suggest people always paper trade. So once you feel like you got an understanding, don't put your money at risk. Just start to get a feel for how these things work in real life and just paper trade. If you like Apple and you feel like you've got a good handle on where it's going to go, start to make some paper trade option calls and see if that works. If you're consistently making money, you're not going to win all the time, but if you're consistent, then maybe move to real money. And real money is probably starting with like one contract at a time. So there's no reason to get aggressive. We've got a whole life to trade and be aggressive with stuff. So why not just trade one contract at a time and see how that goes? You will treat one contract like real money because it is, and you've got skin in the game and you're going to take it really seriously. So I always find that people have a big difference between paper trading and real money trading. But you start with that one contract, you're not going to win or lose too much, but you're really going to take it seriously. So I think that's kind of the evolution that most option traders should have to begin with. And then portfolio size and risk tolerance are two other big things. You know, you have to decide with options, you have to understand they're really, really risky. So they're very volatile. So if you're buying calls and puts, it's going to be volatile. It's much more so than stocks. So you're going to allocate much less into each trade than you would with a stock purchase. If you're comfortable trading $10,000 worth of Apple stock, well, maybe you're only going to trade $1,000 worth of options. Your allocation for each purchase is going to be much smaller because it's so much more leveraged. And then in that trade, what's your risk tolerance going to be? That $10,000 Apple trade, maybe you're willing to lose 5%, and that'd be your risk tolerance. So $10,000, that's a $500 loss. Well, if you're making a $1,000 option trade, you might have that same $500 risk tolerance. So maybe it's a 50% loss on the option trade. So those are the kind of things you just need to keep in mind, like the wild swings you might see happen in options and how you're going to deal with that. I think too many people just hold options too long and they think it'll come back. So for me, I found that if I get down more than 50%, the odds of it coming back are really low. So I'm better to take that 50% loss. It's better to lose 50 than 100%. I say it all the time. So you really got to be careful to keep those losses in check.
Great. So when you're looking at kind of position sizing, and I know I've talked to a lot of options traders and they all have different opinions on this. So I know it makes it hard for people to really kind of grasp a good, you know, basic rule of thumb. But are you looking at, let's say you said like 10,000 shares of Apple stock. Do you look at it as I'm going to do, actually just screwed myself up. That's like what, 100 options? Let's make it simple. Let's do 500 shares of Apple is what you're comfortable with. So okay. That would be 5 contracts. So do you do it based on the same number of position and you just use an option, or do you use it based on the amount that you have invested in the trade?
So for me personally, over the years, so this option portfolio I have is a percentage of my overall total portfolio. But in that option portfolio, I never want to have more than 5% allocated to any one trade at any given time. That's kind of my rule of thumb. So no matter what happens, I'm not going to lose more than 5% of that portfolio on any one trade at any given time. Now, usually it's going to be a 2 or 3% loss. So that's what I'm typically looking at. I don't want to see that happen, but in day-to-day trading, 2 or 3% overall portfolio loss per trade could happen. So 5% kind of gives me a buffer of isolation there that I feel is, it works for me nowadays. So I'll typically start at 2 or 3% allocation into an option. And then if I scale into it, it'll get up to close to 5% if I'm full into it. But you know, if things work out quickly, then I can make a quick trade. I might only have 2 or 3% into the trade. But for me, 5% is kind of the number I've learned over the years. Newer option traders may be, you know, a third of their portfolio might be in it. So if you're trading with a $5,000 account, for example, you know, you might be trading a large percentage of their portfolio in any given trade, but I still would really not advise 100%, or if you're going all in on an option trade, that's, I can't sleep well with that.
Well,
I use that all the time because that's my gut test on trading. If you can't sleep well on it, or if you're nervous, or you go to bed thinking about it, waking up thinking about it, you're too big in that position. So just scale back. Just scale back. Don't worry about leaving money on the table, because losing that money hurts a lot more. So don't worry about not making as much as you could. Worry about sleeping well and, you know, being consistent more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, the sleep at night point, or the trade to your sleeping point, like where you're no longer...
There's one thing I wish I stuck to over the years, it's that. That was an expensive lesson many times in my life, is too confident, too big, and then the market's there to teach you a lesson. So I'm much more cautious about that now.
It's funny how that works, right? It's kind of like karma. It just comes back around. You're on a roll and you start to feel like you're on top of the world and that nothing can go wrong. And then it does.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if it's a few months or a year or so. I mean, you can just be on a roll, and then especially with options, you can give it all back so quickly if you're not careful. So you're just a few bad trades away from seeing a lot of hurt. So I've learned that I'm going to protect myself by not even putting myself in that position. I always want to be in a position to wake up and play tomorrow. I don't want to ever take myself out of the game.
So what are some of your, give me an example of like a bad beat that you got from, I don't want to say at the poker table, because I'm sure you've all had those, but let's say in the options arena, like what's one example that I think people can use as a thing not to do? I've got plenty of those, by the way.
I don't think I've ever shared this one online. Do you want to hear my worst option trade ever?
Sure. Love it. Yeah, we can share stories.
So this was about, I don't know, 4 years ago or so. It was in summer. I think it was August. And just like we were talking about, I was getting too confident in something. I had a strategy selling naked volatility way out of the money. And it was just working month after month. I was collecting, I don't know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month selling out of the money volatility as the markets were trending higher. Things were stable. Volatility always drops. So, you know, this was working really well. Volatility would never get to the point I sold it. So even on the worst days, it would never get anywhere close to how far out of the money I was. So I was just convinced this was a gold maker. I was just going to keep every week, I'd add a little more to it and stretch it out. And this position, I just kept getting bigger and bigger. And then my family and I were going on a cruise out of Boston, and we're headed over to Bermuda for the week. We leave Friday afternoon. Cruise leaves around 3 o'clock or so. And I've got this big volatility position sold short. I'm checking CNBC on the way out. And the markets are getting shaken a little bit. So the market dipped like 1% or 2% or something towards the close. Like, ooh, that was ouch. I'm sure it'll bounce back over the weekend. So we're out on the cruise enjoying it. And sure enough, something happens Monday morning. Can't even remember what it is now. You can go back and find out this day. Just go look at the spike in volatility. It was like 4 years ago. It had the largest overnight move in volatility that's had maybe ever. And I'm on the wrong end of that trade. So I've got all this volatility sold short. Volatility makes a way black swan move against me that I never thought would happen. Even then, it never got to where I was selling out of the money calls without covering them, which I've quickly learned I'm not going to do anymore. So I had this out of the money call sold short, and I was down about $1 million on Monday morning on the cruise. So I was having a really, really rough morning before the market even opened. I was like, oh crap, this is going to change things. This is a lifestyle changer. Oh, God. So I'm down like $1 million. I remember going to the bar at the cruise that morning. It's like 8:30, and they were trying to tell me they'd open until 10. I said, no, nah, man, you open now. We got a long day ahead of us. So the guy opened up the bar and started having a couple drinks there, and I managed it back down to about a $400,000 or $500,000 loss that day. And I was pretty happy at that point, honestly. That was the most stressful trading day ever, and I learned one of the best lessons ever. Fortunately, I was able to survive it, but still, it took like $400,000 or $500,000 hit that one day. So I'd collected like $200,000 or $300,000 in premiums that year leading up to it. So I was really, really confident, and that one day took it all back and more. And that was a huge wake up lesson that there's no strategy out there that's going to be that you continue to get so confident that's not going to have days like that. So that has taught me a lot. That day has never happened again.
Yeah.
If I had held those positions three more days, I would have been back. I would have been green on them all, was the crazy thing. Oof. So volatility goes like that. It goes so high and then comes back down. So if I had held it, I would have been back to even and even made money, but I just couldn't. I had to get out.
Yeah. I mean, there's the stop losses. Sometimes there's that stop loss you just need to hit. It doesn't matter because it could have gotten worse, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, on overnight gaps, there was no stop. You just wake up and you're just blown up. It's like, oh my gosh. So never put yourself in a position where that can happen.
Well, that happened last year when the VIX spiked overnight. I don't know if you're talking about last year, but last year when...
No, this was like 4 years ago, but I remember that time last year. I was not caught on at that time, thank God.
Yeah, we actually had heard a story. A friend of mine called me. He's like, hey, you got to talk to a friend of mine. He was selling, he was selling calls on the VIX or something like that. It was basically, there was an ETF that was kind of short.
Oh, yeah, the VIX. I remember. XIV was the ticker.
Yeah, XIV. It went through the roof. And there was this like open secret on Wall Street, because I used to talk to all my friends. We look at the prospectus and we laugh, and it said this could go to zero. Which we all knew it could, right? Because the investment bank's not going to take the loss. So it effectively did go to zero.
Yeah, but no one ever thinks it really will. They think, well, do you know what has to happen? Like, nah, that'll never happen.
Because that never happens on Wall Street, right?
No, those things never happen. When you hear something that never happens on Wall Street, you should always be careful.
Well, someone had it out for them, because it's just, because I mean, basically this guy was doing this and he was just like you're saying, he was making a mint, making like 35% returns a year, shorting the VIX, and that's great up until it doesn't work anymore, and then the guy loses all his money. And it was just sad, because it's like, what can you do for him? Like, nothing. He's toast. His money's gone. They closed up the ETF. There's nothing you can do. And it wasn't like they didn't disclose it. You know, fortunately, we weren't in that. We were actually on the other side of that, but not, you know, going long puts. But, you know, you look at stuff like that. I'll give you a funny story. And I actually, well, not so funny, but it kind of is along the lines with yours, where I've learned when you go on vacation or when you go on events where you want to relax, you have to like close all your risky positions, which in some cases includes your job. So before we started this firm, I was at another firm, which I won't mention because I don't want to get in trouble on the podcast, but let's just say they were a subsidiary of AIG. And my first anniversary, we went on vacation, and that was the morning that AIG disclosed in the financial crisis. That was
the big day, huh?
That was the big day. Fortunately, my wife is a saint. She's like, I understand, you know, do your thing. I was on the phone all day trying to explain to people that you're fine, your money's safe, you're not in AIG, you're in this subsidiary. But it was a crazy vacation. It was not one that I ever want to take again.
Oh, man.
You know, but Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of stuff you got to deal with, right, when you're trading. So we got to end this soon. I want to ask one or two more questions. But you mentioned you use spreads to sell volatility now, presumably to stop that from happening.
Yes. I mean, I still sell short somewhat naked, but the position size is so much smaller. So I'm not going to wake up to have that kind of loss happen again. And in general, I think spreads are just the way to go for almost everybody. If I'm selling short and trying to collect premium on an option, I'm selling an out-of-the-money call, and then I'm buying an out-of-the-money call, like a strike price or two beyond that. That's kind of like your insurance bet. So you're hoping that first bet, the one you're selling short, you want to collect all the money on that one. And then the one behind it, that's your insurance. That's the one AIG sold you. That's going to protect you from waking up for that $1 million loss, just in case everything goes to hell tonight. That backup bet will be there. You hate that you have to make that backup bet. You want to just collect all the premium, but that's going to protect you because once every year or two, there's going to be something that's going to really go against you. So that protection is really safe.
So when you're selling volatility, you're looking 1 month out still. Are you doing like shorter term or how do you do that?
Depends. I mean, typically my volatility selling will be about 2 weeks out because I'm always cautious of volatility and how fast it can spike. So I feel like when I've got a good read and the market's probably not going to make another dip lower in the next 2 weeks, that's when I'm trying to sell volatility spreads. Or I sell volatility spreads more often, no matter what, actually. Because I'm finding that even when I'm wrong, if I'm selling the spread, I'm losing 1 week. So if I'm selling these consistently every week, I'm losing like an extra week that I didn't have to catch up on. But, you know, 4 weeks, you're going to collect the money. You're going to lose 1 week. So the math just works out. No matter what I think, I'm just going to sell those out of the money call spreads so I'm protected. And they just work out more often than not. So that's something I'm doing more consistently now. Even though I think the market is too high and could pull back, or I think volatility is too sold off, I just find that, man, you have no idea where the bottom is in volatility. It just goes lower and lower and lower. So a lot of times we think that, oh no, volatility is about to reverse. Well, I mean, I know guys who have lost a fortune just trying to bet on the reverse of volatility at any point. You just never, never know. So the better bet's always selling the volatility on the upside, but protect yourself.
That's a great point. I appreciate you sharing that story because that's, I think we all learn from our mistakes, and certainly it's better to learn from the mistakes of others. And God knows I know I have plenty to share here on mistakes. But
thanks for making me dig up that wound. But really, man, that could have been a game ender for me. That could have been the end of my trading career, really. So I really am glad I survived it. And that's something that could happen to anybody. I don't care if it's $1 million or it's 100,000. There's some number that could put you out of the game. And just don't put yourself in a position where that could happen. Because it may not happen this year, may not happen next year, but if you're going to trade as a long-term career, going to come a day or two that something's going to happen that could. So just protect yourself from that.
Yeah, and you raise an interesting point, which I want to kind of point out, is that if you're going to trade or invest for a living, that if you make a career-ending choice, your trading is over. You know, in a lot of ways, your job is to extend your trading career, and if you make mistakes, make them small. Doesn't mean you have to hit home runs every time, but if you don't make huge mistakes that can end your career before it starts, especially at the beginning. I kind of equate it to like the athletes, right? Let's say you're starting with a $100,000 portfolio. It's like an athlete making $10 million a year at the age of 18. Like, you don't really know what you're doing. You're fresh. You think you're on top of the world. And then you're retired at 22 and you're no longer making money. You can't afford to make mistakes. You know, same way with trading. You blow yourself out in a bad trade and you're toast. So,
Man.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did blow up several accounts early on, and those were the ones to blow up. So I had $2,000, $5,000 accounts. I probably did that three or four times in the first few years I traded. And if you're going to do it then. Take the risks, do some stupid things, get out of your system, learn what's going to happen. But you got to learn from those kind of mistakes. So that's one thing I'll say.
Great. Well, let's kind of wrap it up with maybe some final thoughts. What are some kind of final thoughts or words of wisdom you have for some aspiring options traders here?
One of the first things I'd say is that just realize the math behind these, and that it's always, options are always favored in for the seller. So just like we're selling insurance, insurance is always favored to the guy selling it. So Warren Buffett is always on the better end of the deal when you're buying insurance. That's how he's made all his money. So insurance and options are the same way. So if we look at selling options is always better, well, maybe you need to look at strategies that involve more selling options than buying options. Your buying options are, you know, 30 to 40% odds of winning. Your selling options are exactly the opposite. So really consider that. Look at strategies where you can capture premium or time volatility, those kind of things. There's a lot of ways to do it with spreads and just naked selling one way or the other, but find out what works for you. look at it as a long-term thing too. Don't feel like you've got to make a lot of money really quick. I think too many people get into options because they heard Jeff Bishop made $100,000 in an option trade and it went really, really well. And I want to do that. It's like, you know what? There was a lot of time that went into that trade and that didn't happen just by luck. I mean, well, maybe it was. To get to that point, something, I mean, had to have a lot of things go right. People take too much risk to try to make that huge return. And we just talked about it. Our goal is to limit our risks, really. And we don't want to take on an outside number of risks that we don't have to. So limit your risks. And with options, you're going to make more money selling them than buying them. So I'd get more comfortable on that side more than anything. If you can make a return selling options year after year that outperforms the market, which I think you probably can, then you are doing really well. You're beating almost every hedge fund out there. So good for you.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your words of wisdom. This has been a great interview. I've loved it, and hopefully the listeners do as well. You know, this is one of those topics that is kind of not looked at or talked about all that much, and so I really appreciate your thoughts here. Where can our listeners find out more about you if they want to learn more about what you've got going on, which, by the way, is pretty interesting, so I highly suggest you all kind of check them out.
Yeah, so Jeff Bishop, I'm a co-founder of RagingBull.com. We're probably the fastest growing financial stock market education service out there. So you'll find us at RagingBull.com. I'm an options educator there. So you can actually see all the options I'm trading in real time and how I do it. And I'll teach you about it. We also have 7 other incredible professional traders who are doing this day after day in the market with their own real money. And you can see what they're doing at any given time. So it's a cool community. We've got a lot of people. It's helped a lot of people become much, much better traders. So I just encourage you to stop by. It's absolutely free. Just take a look and see what you think.
Hey, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We've had a great run over the last 5 years. We've had lots of great guests over that time. Guests like Joe Saul Sehy, Susie Orman, Art Laffer, Burton Malkiel, Peter Schiff, and more. We've had lots of great content, too. Like what happens when somebody steals $500,000 from you? Tax loopholes for the rich. Investing like a billionaire. Why men and women approach investing differently, how to outlive your money, tax liens, peer-to-peer lending, asset protection, and more. And we've had lots of great questions from you, our audience, as well, and we really appreciate it. But now we need your help. We want to know what you want to listen to, what topics, guests, and content you value most. This is your chance, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We don't ask frequently, but when we do, the door is wide open for you to give us your thoughts, good, bad, and ugly. What do you want to hear more of? What do you want to hear less of? All this helps to make a better show for you. So many of you have already provided your feedback, and it's going to make an exciting 2019 of great content ahead. We're going to be closing the survey soon, so make sure you leave your feedback now. If having a say in your favorite podcast isn't enough, we're also going to be providing monthly promotions to anyone on our email list. The recent promotion was an overwhelming success. We had lots of positive feedback and input from our listeners. We're going to continue to create great shows for you, and they'll be focused on the content that you suggested. Each month, we're going to have a new promotion. We can't tell you now quite what we have in store for you because we want it to be a surprise, but we know that you're going to be excited. We have some special opportunities that money can't buy. We're excited to bring these to you through the year 2019. But in order to qualify for these promotions, we need to hear from you. In order to qualify, you're going to need to sign up for our email list first. When you do, you're going to have an additional chance to win by completing our Money Tree Podcast survey. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to give us your feedback and the additional chance to win. We'll be posting the name of the winner on our website. So if you entered the promotion, please check the website to see that you've won. We also have great shows lined up in the near future with some special guests that you're not going to want to miss. I can't wait to publish these interviews. They're very exciting. So go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to sign up, and we'll enter you into our monthly promotion. Thanks again for listening, and remember, invest in your life. Let's move into the panel portion of our show. We have a great panel today. We have Barb Freeburg. How are you doing today, Barb?
I'm doing great.
Great. Well, glad to have you back. Your show about robo-advisors was awesome. And I know we got a lot of positive feedback from our listeners. So I think they can definitely learn a lot from you today on this topic. So glad you're here.
Thank you.
And we also have Tim Pachote. Tim, how are you doing today?
Doing well, Kirk. Living the dream as usual. Thanks for having me back.
Living in balmy Arizona in the middle of summer. Nice.
I don't mind the hot weather as long as you're by a pool. It's fine.
Nice. Well, today we're going to be talking about options investing. And I was fascinated with Jeff's interview. I love options. I certainly use them with my investing style. So I'm glad we had a chance to have him on. And I think this panel will be great because we have two very knowledgeable people. So, Barb, maybe you can start by defining what options are. Puts, calls, spreads. I think that'll help put all this into context for people who are not familiar with options.
Okay. Options are the right, but not the obligation, to take some sort of action by a predetermined date. So let me get into specifics. So a call option gives the right to buy an underlying stock or fund at a predetermined price by a certain date. You can buy the shares at the strike price until the option expires. And a put option gives the buyer the right to sell shares at the strike price. And if she or he decides to sell, the put writer or seller is obliged to buy at that price. So you're never actually holding the real security. You're holding the right to buy or sell it at a certain price.
Yeah, that's really important. And I think options for a lot of people is tricky initially. I know when I first learned about them, they're in some ways, they're polar opposites, calls and puts in the way that they're constructed. But for reference, let's take an example because there's a lot of listeners who are investors in real estate. Let's say you wanted to buy a piece of real estate worth $100,000 and you didn't want to put $100,000 up to buy it, but you wanted the right to buy it at some future date. So you might pay the owner $1,000 for the right to buy that property at $100,000 within the next 5 years. So if the property goes up, let's say it goes up to $110,000, then you could use your option to buy it at $100,000 and you would make a $10,000 profit minus the $1,000 that you had spent for the option. So it just gives you the right and it doesn't require you to put up the whole amount. So like buying a stock, 100 shares of stock is trading $100. Instead of putting up $10,000, you may only put up $200. So you're able to use some leverage in the equation, which I think is very powerful if you're using it right. But Tim, what do you think about investing in options?
Well, I think first off, you know, a lot of people have a lot of common misconceptions. And I think one of those misconceptions is that it's always going to be pretty much like the riskiest thing you can do. Because basically, you can have using options, you can have it be the riskiest thing you can possibly do. Or you can also have it be as part of a portfolio to have it be some of the more conservative investing you do, depending on if you're using it to protect the downside risk. And so I think just going out there trying to educate the public that, you know, it's not, you know, and certainly for a lot of people, they see a shiny object that's out there and they see maybe, you know, somebody on CNBC or maybe Pete Najarian slinging a book or something, and they're trying to juice up these returns. But for many people, I think that there just needs to be a more of an awareness of how they can use it to help protect the downside. Because you see a lot of people who just camp out in cash, maybe they keep everything in, you know, quote unquote, safe assets, but they don't really ever get the upside. And what they don't realize is that you could use, you know, a small amount of your portfolio to help protect the downside. And so that way, if there is a catastrophic, you know, like 2007, 2008 type event, they can be protected to the downside. But, you know, if we, who knows, I think if we timestamp this today is July 10th, the Federal Reserve could announce even, you know, maybe even right now that there are potentially cutting rates. And who knows, maybe this time next year, they're going to announce that they're printing more money, in which case, you know, you probably want to be invested into the stock market. So options, there's more than one way to skin a cat on this. And I usually refer to our local options expert, Kirk Chisholm, when it comes to different advice on what's the best way to implement some of these strategies. You know, you could use options to help protect the downside, or you could use a small amount of money, like Kirk was talking about, to then leverage the upside. Whereas if it's like, hey, I don't want to put all this money at risk, we'll take a flyer on this. So we'll put a small amount up front. And then if it ends up panning out, it pans out really well. But you've got to be careful because you can't put all of your money into options, because it could be a very easy way to, you know, if you want to make $1 million, you know, maybe you start with, you know, two on this if it ends up, you know, going wrong. But unfortunately, when things go wrong in options, if you don't know what you're doing, you could easily lose everything. So this is not for something to just jump into if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think you raised some good points about the risks, Tim, and we're definitely going to get into that in a little bit. What about you, Barb? What are your thoughts about investing in options?
Well, I really liked what Tim said, which was the insurance side, because how the insurance works is you can put a floor on the amount of money that you are willing to lose with an options strategy and by selling options. So that way you are gaining money. You're earning money when you sell options on stocks or funds that you already own. And if perchance the option, the underlying security falls, then the option buyer gets that security. But in the interim, you've made money and you've accepted the fact that you might have to sell that security. So I think for the insurance side, options can be, you know, really a smart strategy, but they're tricky. And there's a learning curve. And so they're only for the individuals that, A, either have a broker or an investment advisor who really is familiar with options and can help you with the trades, or if you're willing to put the time in. Because like any more complex or sophisticated investment strategy, you want to know what you're doing before you get into it.
Yeah, and those are some great points, Barb. I also agree with the insurance side. That's something that we don't use enough of. As Tim mentioned, a lot of people look at options as risky, and plenty of quote unquote experts out there will say you shouldn't invest in options, they're risky. Well, it's actually quite the opposite. When options were created, they were created to manage risk. So the whole point of options was to manage the risk on other positions. So if you own 100 shares of a stock, you basically own the volatility on that stock. So you bought the position, it can go up, it could go down. As Jeff had mentioned on the show, like Tesla is a very polarizing topic. People either think it's going to zero or it's going to the moon, which I guess Elon Musk may be going to the moon, to excuse the pun, but that's a whole nother story. But if you look at stuff like that, it's a perfect example why options make sense. Because if you're, let's say you're, I don't want to use Tesla's example and I'll get in trouble, but, you know, effectively, let's say you have a stock like that with that kind of volatility and that kind of dynamic. Let's say the stock could easily go to zero or it could go up tenfold, like cryptocurrency, right? Like, I think the, and Tim could talk about this, obviously, he's the expert, resident expert here on crypto, but certainly crypto could go to zero. It's possible. Or it could go up 10 or 20 times. You know, it's a perfect example why you might use an option, because if it goes to zero, you would lose 100% of your money. But if you're using an option, maybe you're not putting up 100% of your money. Maybe you're only putting up 2% of your money or 3% of your money, right? So if you're losing all of it, you'd only lose 3% as opposed to 100% of it. And that's a really important part of this, because if you're talking about managing risk, what you're managing is your maximum loss. And if you're only putting up like 2% of your portfolio into options and you lose all of it, then you've lost 2% as opposed to 40 or 50%. So managing risk is a really important part of an options strategy. Now, you can certainly use it to speculate, which people do, which I think is what Jeff's strategy is, but he does it in a risk managed way. Where I think a lot of investors get themselves into trouble is because they're taking risks that they don't understand that they're taking, as Barb had mentioned. Understanding what you're doing is really important when it comes to options. I've spent a lot of time learning about options over years, and it's very mathematical. So if you're into math, then it's actually an interesting strategy you can use. Barb, what are some of the risks that are inherent in using options?
Well, one risk is over-leveraging. First of all, leverage means you're buying something with borrowed money or with money you don't have. And by over-leveraging, each standard put or call is equal to 100 shares of the underlying stock or ETF. And they cost significantly less to initiate versus just buying the stock or ETF outright. So you can easily, if you make the wrong choice or the options trade doesn't go in the way that you would like, you can lose 100% of your money much more easily than if you are long a stock. If you're long a stock, it's unlikely that stock is going to fall 100%. With an option, it's much more easy to get to that 100% loss. So you really want to make sure that you have a significant limit on the amount of money that you can stand to lose. Be aware that that can happen, like was discussed in the prior segment, where he was doing great with his option strategy until he wasn't. And his position went down, you know, into seven figures.
You made a great point about position sizing, which I think he talked about as well. And we can certainly get into that if we have the time. But what about you, Tim? What are some of the risks that of using options that you've seen?
Well, one of the risks is you've got, was it Warren Buffett who called options weapons of, was it financial mass destruction or something like that, from paraphrasing. And then you also have, I mean, we're, again, we are time stamping something twice in one day. I think it's the first time I've ever used that phrase. But here we have Deutsche Bank that, what was it, just yesterday announced that they're laying off, I think it was something like 18,000 people. Or maybe it was just 18,000 in America and like 30,000 total. But I think a lot of that has to do with probably them mismanaging their options, and they have, you know, a lot of derivatives exposure. And so it's something where if it's not handled correctly, you can quickly find yourself on the wrong side of a trade. And if it's not managed correctly, you can quickly find yourself bankrupt, or in the case of an individual or a company. And so, you know, weapons of financial mass destruction, but like nuclear power, you know, it could be used for a lot of good, or like nuclear energy, it can be used for a lot of destruction as well. And I think that's a good way of putting it.
It kind of brings up a point about last year in 2018 in February, when the VIX spiked through the roof almost overnight. A lot of investors actually end up losing money because there were some funds out there, and I won't name any names, but you probably find them easily enough. There's some funds out there that were claiming that they were conservative and low risk. And what they were doing is they were selling options, which is a very conservative strategy if done correctly. You know, it's writing covered calls, it's generating income from your account. And so, you know, it's a decent strategy if you use it properly. Unfortunately, what some of these people were doing is they were selling options on the VIX. And effectively what happened is they were, as we call it, picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. So they're making a little bit of money here and there, but they were picking up pennies, and then they just got steamrolled because they lost everything. Like the fund effectively went to zero or close to it. And I actually came in contact with some investors. They weren't investors that were clients of ours, but I had come in contact with them after. I mean, they had seven figures.
Can I add on to that?
Sure, go ahead.
So I actually have a client who they had most of their money with me, had a small amount of money with their other advisor, and they actually had them in this fund where, I don't want to name the fund, but it was something conservative fund. And I don't even remember what the name of it was, because they were basically selling options against the VIX. And we're probably talking about the same fund over here. And what's actually funny about that is, well, I guess nothing's funny about losing all of your money in that fund. But on January 26, 2000, and I believe it was that 17 or 18? Again, all my years 18. Mixed up. January 26 of 2018, I was on another radio show that I think we know, that we have a mutual friend with, who's the host of that show. And I said on his show, January 26, that the worst thing you could possibly do right now is to short the VIX. And probably, what was it, like 2 weeks later or a week and a half later, you had like three or four funds that basically effectively blew up and went to zero. And these are professional fund managers who blew up their own funds and went to zero. And so, things can get out of hand pretty quickly, even if you're doing quote unquote safe things. So always do your due diligence. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, it was a very safe strategy to the day it wasn't. And so things can move quickly on you in the options world.
Yeah. And I think the relevant point that you bring up that I think people should understand is that the strategy was promoted as being conservative and safe. It wasn't actually safe, because what they were doing is they didn't understand the risk that they were taking. If they understood the risk they were taking, they never would have called it conservative, because effectively the ETF that they were investing in, the prospectus clearly stated this could lose all its money and go to zero. And I actually got emails, there were memes about this fund, because everybody was laughing about the fact that, oh, this thing could go to zero. It was no secret for people who are asset managers. But apparently the people managing the fund didn't understand the risks they were taking, or maybe they understood them and minimized them, thinking this could never happen, right? Like real estate will never go down. So I think it's important is just understanding the risk. And options, the nice part is you can define your risk. Like, it's very clearly defined what your risks are. So you know what they are if you understand how options work. It's just a function of how much risk you're willing to take and how you want to construct it. Because one of the nice parts about options is it allows you to, let's say you have a thesis, and your thesis is the market goes sideways for the next year. You could use an option strategy to benefit from that. Whatever you think the market's going to do, you can construct an option strategy around that if you understand how to do them properly. They're really important tools, and if people use them well, they can very effectively. So what are some other ways that people can generate, use options to generate returns? What are your thoughts, Barbara?
Well, you can sell if you have, like I mentioned, so you can sell call options on stocks you already own. So you've got IBM stock and you think it's just going to trade within a range for, you know, the next several months. So you sell options on that. If the stock trades within the range and doesn't drop to the strike price, then you collect the money. And you have to be willing to accept the fact that if you're wrong, then the worst that's going to happen is when the stock price matches the strike price, you're going to lose that stock. It's going to sell. But in the meantime, if it trades within the range that you had predicted, then you're going to collect the premiums over and over and over and over again. That's a really conservative option, and you can make some money.
Yeah, it's actually one of the few strategies that our industry can call conservative, right, Barb? I mean, retirees can use this as a strategy to generate additional income if you're doing it properly. Like, the industry considers it low risk or conservative, I would say, right?
Absolutely. And I think the choice you have is there are tons of resources online where you can learn about options trading and you can construct these trades on your own, but you really have to understand what you're doing. And you have to understand the basics. What is a strike price? What is the expiration date? What's the difference between a call and a put? Who's the writer? Who's the buyer? Chicago Board of Options Trading has wonderful courses on that. Or you can work with an advisor. You know, you don't even have to put all of your money with the advisor, but you can work with an advisor like Kirk who knows these type of strategies and can help you along. But yeah, it's a very conservative strategy, and you can make some money doing that.
Yeah, I totally agree. What about you, Tim? What are your thoughts? What are some ways that you've seen people use options to generate returns?
Well, I think Barbara sort of stole my thunder talking about the covered calls. But that would be, you know, if you're not, you just think that something could be range bound, and or, you know, it sort of depends on what someone's sentiment of a particular stock is. But yeah, I guess just laying off what both you and Barb said, that it is a way to make a very conservative strategy, but you know, you can also use it to juice returns as well. So, you know, I think there just needs to be more education around the fact that this can be a way to be conservative while still being able to, you know, get some upside on there as well.
Yeah. And I think the writing covered calls, or I used to use cash covered puts, which effectively the same thing, you know, as a strategy when we had a VIX that was a lot lower. So the volatility is lower, so you get less income when the VIX is lower, and you get more income when the VIX is higher. You know, you have to kind of play the timing of it to make the optimal returns. But some of the other strategies that people use, like they'll buy puts outright, assuming the market's going to go down, or they're buying calls, assuming the market's going to go up. And one thing you have to be careful of is the time value. So if you're buying a call, assuming that the next 6 months, the market's going to go higher, as long as it goes higher, you're fine. But if it goes sideways for 6 months, then you're effectively going to lose the premium that you put up because it will erode over time. And that's really what works in your favor with writing covered calls, because if the stock goes up or sideways, then you benefit from the covered call. Some other strategies, I think some people get in trouble, or they don't get into trouble, but they lose the benefit is that if they're buying a call, you know, it'll cost you a certain amount of money, and people get really, the allure is that the stock is going to go to the moon, right? Or it's going to go to zero. If you're buying a put, the stock's not going to go to zero. It's possible, but it's highly unlikely. So a better way that some people use to buy calls or buy puts is they'll use a spread. The spread is effectively a way to lessen your cost, and you have a very defined upside and downside. It's within a range, so it's range bound. So you don't have infinite upside with calls, you know, like you do with buying a call. It would be a limited upside, but you're also, your call will cost you less. So it's something that when I realized the benefits of using spreads, it just opened up a whole new world for me for strategies. And I would say that of many of the options professionals I've spoken to, the professional traders, many of them will use spreads because of that defined risk reward is much more clear, and it's more cost effective than just, you know, buying a call or buying a put. So it also, it spreads can get a little trickier because there's two positions as opposed to one, but it is something worth looking into if you're considering options.
Hey, Kirk, I just wanted to make sure that all the listeners actually know what the VIX is, because the VIX is actually an index created by the Chicago Board Options Exchange, and it's called the Volatility Index. And it's a real-time market index that represents what the market expects the volatility of the S&P 500 will be in the next 30 days. It's kind of a way to tell how the market believes that the S&P 500 will trade. Is it going to go up, be up and down a lot, or is it going to be rather steady? And other names for it is the fear gauge or the fear index. So people trade on that, and that's what we mean by the VIX.
Yeah, I appreciate you clarifying that, Barb. You're definitely keeping us in line here, because sometimes I certainly forget about certain terms, and they're foreign to people who are not used to using them, but that's great. And the VIX is a really important part of options. So if you don't understand what the VIX is, you need to really learn it.
I did also want to bring up another topic. I don't know if now's the place. I wanted to talk a little more about risk in general.
Absolutely. We love talking about risk and risk management. So go ahead, Barb. You take the stage here.
Okay. I don't want to take over the whole show.
No,
but
do it.
Actually, this is great. Okay. Thank you. All the glory and none of the work, right?
You're welcome.
No problem. Anytime. So I actually have an article coming out next week, next Wednesday, at U.S. News and World Report in their investing vertical, and it's all about risk. So often, we think about risk as it's the likelihood that we're going to lose money, or it's how much standard deviation or up and down in volatility a stock or a fund has. But there are other risks too, and that is, how much can you personally afford to lose before it's a problem for you? So do you have enough money to meet your short and intermediate goals? And that gets to the fact of, don't put any money in the stock market, in options, or in any other strategy that has the potential for loss that you're going to need in the next couple of years. If you want to buy a house in 2 years and you need a couple $100,000, or say $50,000 as a down payment, keep that money in cash or cash-like investments. Okay, that's the end of my pitch.
I think that was awesome, Barb. I appreciate you stepping in to talk about risk, because that's an important topic that it's near and dear to my heart, because we focus on risk management first here. But I think a lot of people don't put enough time into kind of the risk, understanding the risk. What about you, Tim? Do you have any thoughts on what Barb had talked about?
Just put it all in Bitcoin if you don't know what you're doing. Just kidding. Actually, yesterday I did have to convince a lady who was selling her house not to put everything into cryptocurrencies.
Oh my goodness.
Congratulations.
You're doing the Lord's work.
No, I didn't. I don't think I've got too much more to add. You know, with options, I think if I tried to get any deeper into it, I'd probably bore everybody. And so I think both of you guys did a good job of breaking things down in terms of, you know, why people should, you know, look into options. And if they aren't working with an advisor, I know a good one in Kirk Chisholm, who is an expert in options, and especially during these volatile times where, you know, if you're close to retirement or you're already retired, the biggest risk you face is something called, one of the biggest risks is called a sequence of return risk, where it doesn't matter if you're 65 and you average 10% a year, if you retire in day one, the market goes down, you know, 20, 30, 40%. And now you've got to start withdrawing 4%. I forgot the exact math, but it's something like if you're pulling out 4% a year, the market goes down 20, you know, the amount that you've got to go up to help overcompensate for that is pretty staggering. And I wish I had the exact number in front of me, but you know, most people don't factor in the fact that if they're taking out money, if you go, let's say go down 20%, you got to go back up 40, get back to even. Well, if you're withdrawing money, that number is even higher. So it could be, you know, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100% if you're actively pulling out money. And option strategy could be a good way to hedge yourself, especially while you're in that really volatile time period of your life.
Yeah, and it's funny, it's always existed, but for whatever reason, people are now starting to talk about it. Maybe it's probably you, Tim, that brought that up, but it's something that I think people are highly attuned to because the markets are toppy here. That's great. So let's kind of wrap it up here because we're coming up on time. But Tim, where can people find more about you?
You can find more about me actually at sequenceofreturnrisk.com. I own that one. LibertyAdvisor.com. You can find out all the information. And I did just look it up. So if you lost 20% and you're withdrawing 4 over the next 3 years, you'd have to gain 42% to get back to even. If you went down 50% and were withdrawing 4, you'd have to go up 132%. To get back to even, sourcing that is Prudential. You got to find out more about that at thelibertyadvisor.com/sequenceofreturnrisk. But yeah, you guys can find me there and World Alternative Media on YouTube. I do a lot of videos on there, and I'm sure you can find me here as well.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on, Tim. What about you, Barb? Where can people find more about you?
Kirk, you can read about me at roboadvisorpros.com. That is my newest baby, and it's all about investing with less work, with more help from your digital computerized algorithms. And again, it's Robo Advisor Pros.
Yeah, Barb's being a little modest. Barb is everywhere. So
she's thank you,
Kirk. A terrific writer and a great portfolio manager. And I'm glad we have her on the show this week. And we'll definitely have her on again. But if you haven't heard the show on Robo Advisors, it's phenomenal. So I highly suggest you listen to it. And my name is Kirk Chisholm. I'm a wealth manager at Innovative Advisory Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. And I'm pretty much also everywhere in social media, so I'm hard to miss. So please remember to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Play. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to all our resources, show notes, and archive shows. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comments on the podcast app of your choice. When you subscribe and rate to the show, it actually allows us to have better access to some of the top guests that you're going to want to hear. So please rate and give your comments so we can improve the show for all of you. Have a great week ahead. And remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.